Blog Talk Radio.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand in the street, singing songs and they're carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Revolution Radio. This is Dr. Kate, and we're going to be doing a couple of things this evening. First of all, we're going to have just an update on the Restore America plan. It's now apparently surfacing in the media and the lamestream media, as we say. And also, there are a couple of other interesting pieces of this. The Restore America plan, I'm putting it in the chat room right now. It's the Logistics Monster link that you can go to. Restore America Plan surfaces, and then a link today that talks about the smearing that's going on. Apparently what this is and it surfaced about a week and a half ago, at least for me, is a plan for the restoration of government back to the Constitution, and it involves replacing the de facto government with a de jure government. The documents are actually very well written and so forth and so on, and you can get them in this link if you'd like to. But let's put it this way. Apparently all 50 state governors were served with these letters. There's apparently the military involved as well. And there's a group called the Guardians of the Free Republic putting together what is called the Restore America Plan. Now, let's look at this broadly. It's, you know, almost too good to be true. Who knows what it is? The acronym is TRAP, the Restore America Plan. But this week, governors were served. And you may have seen some reports from Nevada, Michigan, Louisiana, some other states and so forth, where they got the letters, they turned them over to the FBI. Everyone who got the letters described them as non-threatening, but the FBI put out a warning, and of course Homeland Security did too. Oh, and just coincidentally, there was a raid on a supposedly, quote, Christian militia group this week as well. And we find out that, interestingly enough, the Fed has scheduled a meeting on Monday. So these letters are to go to everybody, the Supreme Court, leaders of Congress, the states, and so forth and so on. It sounds like a top-down effort, but it's building from the ground up. Who knows? Check it out. It's quite interesting. So the Tea Party Express is rolling along, and there is also just a huge amount of more information coming out about Barack Obama. They finally found the YouTube where Michelle says that Barack is born in, she doesn't say that, but she says Kenya is his home country. And it turns out that that YouTube, which is now widely placed everywhere, and especially on my blog, which I'll put up in a second, is also on Obama's blog. But that piece where she refers to Barack's homeland of Kenya is scrubbed, just like everything else. So to me, it's kind of curious that now a whole bunch of stuff is coming out. The report on how the law professors at the University of Chicago really disliked Obama, this tape, videotape of Michelle. Maybe that was the original videotape we were all looking for a year ago. And a couple of other things that are coming out. So it's quite interesting. I'm quite interested in this Restore America plan. Keep your eyes out. The smear is already beginning to start happening. So we're going to want to pay attention to that. Okay. Now, this evening, we are pleased to have Paradigm Shift episode number 4 from Jeff Williams from Washington State, who does Paradigm Shift. His website is commonsensejeff.com, and you can find all of his broadcasts, which we do regularly on Saturday nights when we can. And before we get to that, I'm going to play a song that kind of characterizes, I think, where we are. We now understand that we've had 100 years of tyranny, that the 20th century was a tragedy and a wasted opportunity. Look at the wars. Look at the poverty that still exists in the world. Look at the enslavement as well of the American people, all for the money, all for the banksters and the money folks. Wars, poverty, trauma, and really when you think about the number of people who really control things in this world, it's probably not more than 2,000 people. So I'm going to play this video because they all want to control the world, and they are now, or not the video, the song, they are now being exposed, and we're not going back. The rocks are uncovered now. We're looking everywhere for these people. And nothing lasts forever, and neither will their tyranny. So before I play that, let me say again a special welcome to our soldiers and military. God bless America, and let's go ahead and play this song. It's about 4 minutes, and then we'll be back with Jeff Williams' podcast. Thanks. Here we go. Thank you. Terrific song. Welcome back, everybody. This is a special edition of Revolution Radio. We are now going to move right into Paradigm Shift, Episode 4, with Jeff Williams, Continental Congress delegate from Washington State, wrote the Declaration and Resolves of the Articles of Freedom, a patriot, fighter, wonderful person. Here we go, and enjoy.
During the 2008 campaign, then-Senator Barack Obama floated a lot of ideas that the public just wasn't too crazy about, including a civilian national security force. Well, we haven't heard much about that since, but when I was flipping through the recently passed so-called Health Reform Act, H.R. 3590, guess what I found? You're not going to like the answer. How does government keep tabs on its citizens? Data being collected from all over the place, centrally accessible in one location, from your taxes to your DMV records to your latest trip to the grocery store, and coming soon maybe your medical and DNA records. They are called fusion centers. And John Bush from Texans for Responsible Government and Operation Defuse joins us with his minority report. And it's been said that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Author and history professor Larry Schweikert from the University of Dayton joins us to discuss his books, Seven Events That Made America, America, and A Patriot's History of the United States. My name is Jeff Williams, and it's time for a paradigm shift.
Sooner or later, you've got to draw a line and stand your ground, whether anybody else does or not. That is what liberty is all about.
And now, our nation is drifting dangerously from freedom.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Those people that have a diametrically opposing point of view than yours, they will figure out the learning curve, they will mail the letters, and they will make the phone calls. They will show up in numbers, they will overwhelm you, because your butt is on the couch thinking that right about now would be a great time for somebody else to go out and fix this problem.
Great principles don't get lost once they come to light. They're right here.
There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right.
It's a, quote, conspiracy of ideas. This is an ideological battle. Some people believe in globalism. Others of us believe in national sovereignty.
How long is it going to be before you finally resist and say no? I will not comply. Period.
Giving a huge shout out to the angry mob. My name is Jeff Williams. Thank you for joining us. This is Paradigm Shift number 4. If you need to reach me, you can do so on the web. CommonSenseJeff.com via email, me at CommonSenseJeff.com. Skype, Common Sense Jeff, Twitter, Common Sense Jeff, and so on and so forth. Before we get into the meat of the matter today, I'd like to say thank you. And I'm keenly aware in this day and age that you have a ton of different places you can get your information. The time is at a premium, and I so appreciate you guys listening, subscribing, downloading, telling your friends. And as long as you keep doing it, I'm going to keep making the program. And, you know, we have had some really good numbers so far, and we hope to keep it up. And I hope to continue to bring you a program that it's entertaining. It is full of integrity. If I don't believe it, I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to bring it to you. I double-check and triple-check facts. I'm really trying to do something positive and accurate. And I hope that it comes through. I'm not making any money at this. I don't have any plans on making any money at this. It's a super small operation. It's me in my spare time. I hope that I'm creating a quality production that you really do enjoy. Okay, so we've got that out of the way. Now let's take a moment and answer a question that I receive frequently and have not responded to yet in the program. This is something that's been coming in almost since the very first episode of this program, and that is, why are you not more topical? Why are you not covering current events? And, you know, the answer I thought was obvious. But as my friend Michael Bednarik likes to say, there is no such thing as obvious. So let me explain, you know, what's going on here. This program works on a two-week production cycle, which in English, that means from the minute I sit down and start doing a program, that includes contacting guests, getting those interviews scheduled, getting those interviews recorded, mixing everything down, chopping it up, packaging it up, and shooting it out to the web so you can download it. You know, things change. Things change daily. And unless you are doing that type of a daily show and have, you know, sponsors backing you and you have a production staff and you've got all these different elements that go into, you know, a program like Beck, Limbaugh, Jones, Blood, it ain't going to happen. It's just not feasible. Even if we were on a weekly schedule, and at that point, you know, we do need sponsorship because of the amount of time that's going into this on a weekly basis, I don't see it being that immediate, current event, you know, news that's breaking now type of a show. And that also is a strength of this program, to be honest with you, because I don't want to reinvent the wheel. There are so many different shows that are doing that, that are accessible in other ways than the web and podcasting. It makes absolutely no sense for you to come to me, you know, Joe Schmo, know-nothing guy that does this as kind of a hobby. It doesn't make any sense for you to come to me for that stuff when you can get it from these other individuals. So, you know, we do try to create something different, something that's bigger picture. The other thing to really think about, too, is just because of the nature of how this works. You know, people come out and they find us on iTunes or through the RSS feed, and sometimes they may download show number one first. Well, show number one may be 2 months old. It may be 4 months old. Obviously, there is a shelf life to every program that we do, because even on the long term, stuff changes, news gets old, but at the same time, we try to make these things understandable and accessible for as long a period of time as possible, because this is the medium that we are working with. It's the car that we're dealt. So that's an explanation. Hope it makes sense to you. You know, as we go, we will cover current events a little bit more in depth, but for the most part, we do stick to bigger pictures here on Paradise.
Okay, folks, I want to send a message now to the average Austin Police Department officer, to the average beat cop.
But we want you guys to know that we, the people, are peaceful. We, the people, want to fight this revolution with love, not fear, hate, and certainly not violence. So if the Austin Police Department, be it the normal beat cop or Chief Acevedo himself, if they ever get the order from the feds to come gun grabbing, we want you to know that that would not be in your best interest.
Because we all know the reason why we have the Second Amendment, it's not to go shooting out in the woods and to go hunt, ladies and gentlemen. It's to protect us from tyrannical government, right?
That's John Bush. My name is Jeff Williams, and welcome back to Paradigm Shift. In fact, joining me on the line right now is John Bush. He's on the road. Where are you, John?
I believe I'm driving to Connecticut.
And you're just activism full-time now?
Activism full-time, yeah. I've captain flashed myself and hitting the road, visiting fusion centers and different activist communities, spreading the word, learning the mechanics of the police state.
And, you know, 2 years ago, if somebody said conservative activism, that's like military intelligence. It's like a total oxymoron, but not anymore. And what's that been like for you?
It's been great. Activism's great. And one of the things that we're doing is, rather than calling your congressman and asking and begging him not to take your rights away or not to create a surveillance state or to further the whole Big Brother paradigm, well, we're actually going out and we're meeting face-to-face Big Brother, so to speak, and meeting with these different FBI agents and the directors of these fusion centers. So it's great. It's direct activism, you know, bypassing your representative and going to get a taste of what's going on in this country for yourself.
Well, I think that one of the themes that we've kind of been pushing on this program since day one is, you know, we've been asleep for far too long. People have been complacent. People have not been getting involved. Now, most people can't get involved to the point that you are. I mean, you've kind of dedicated your entire life to this. Most people can't pick up and do it. But I think we have got to come to the reality that it is time to get off the couch and get involved and stay involved permanently. It has to be a complete, I hate to say it, paradigm shift in how we look at life in the United States.
Yeah, if you value at all what this country is and what it really means, what our Constitution and Declaration of Independence represent, and exactly how far we've come as a civilization towards the sovereignty of man, and you understand the direction that we're taking now, which many people do, and many more people are beginning to wake up, as you said, then yeah, it's definitely, it's worth a little bit of sacrifice and discomfort now. I heard one of the guys that was doing a hunger strike for the Continental Congress, the Articles of Freedom. We interviewed him on a program, and he had said that he would voluntarily go through discomfort now so his children aren't forced to go through discomfort in the future. And, yeah, it's not going to be easy, but it's time for us to rededicate ourselves and at least kick up an extra couple hours when you can. It's crunch time.
Well, you mentioned Continental Congress. That's where I got to know you, and that's where I got to learn about something that I'd never heard of before. And, in fact, that's the reason why we've got you on the program today, and that is this concept of fusion centers. Obviously, in the information age we live in, there is a ton of data that is collected about us all the time, from the time you wake up in the morning and start doing things. If you are interacting with electronic gear, from your purchases to your use on the computer, whatever it is, all that data has to aggregate somewhere. And my understanding of that is where the fusion center comes in. Tell us more about fusion centers, John.
Sure. Well, we actually, Catherine Bleich, to start with, I'm sure many listeners are familiar with the MIAC report, the Missouri Information Analysis Report on the Modern Militia Movement. It went over a bunch of violent activities that were apparently carried out by the militia in the early 90s and all the way through the 2000s, post 9/11. And then it went on to say, here are some common things that would lead you to believe that the person you're dealing with could be a militia member. And that listed Ron Paul bumper stickers. They support Constitution Party. They support Campaign for Liberty, Libertarian Party. And this whole document basically puts in the head of law enforcement that individuals that hold these beliefs and that stick to the Constitution, that are against the Real ID, that are against the North American Union, and so on, could be potential threats to you. They'd say, you are the enemy. It lists that right there. That document actually came out of a fusion center. Basically, what a fusion center is, I like to say, is the horizontal and vertical merging of the intelligence and information sharing practices of various law enforcement agencies, from the local, state, and federal level, all the way up to the Department of Homeland Security, up to the international police, even sharing information with foreign governments as well, all the way down to your local police department or your local grocery store in some instances. They're basically taking, it's not the merging of information into one central database, rather these fusion centers, there's 72 of them in the country. What they do is they create a point of fusion where different law enforcement agencies or private sector partners are able to access information that at first it would have been difficult for them to find, but there's a spider work of information sharing channels set up between, Travis County Sheriff Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the New Orleans Police Department perhaps. The way they justify it, this information sharing, it's called intelligent policing. That's what the fusion center brings, and they're trying to basically prevent crime from happening by gathering as much information that could potentially indicate a crime or a terrorist activity is about to happen. And so they say if you get a partial plate in Travis County and then two counties north, somebody robbed a bank in Travis County, the witness only got a partial plate, and then two counties up north, there's another robbery happening, and they get the other side of the plate, fusion center would be able to mend that together. And while that does sound, and that actually would help local law enforcement, there's much more to the fusion centers than simply connecting the dots for local crimes. And again, the whole intelligence-led policing ties into that. And the biggest problem that many of your listeners will probably relate to is the merging of the federal government and the United States military also with local law enforcement and state police. They're basically backdooring, through administrative fiat rather than the legislatures voluntarily saying we want the federal government to come in and to commandeer, in a sense, our local law enforcement. They're using grants and Department of Homeland Security, administrative fiat, again, to basically merge not only the information sharing practices, but also the training, and now we see the militarization as well of local law enforcement.
Well, on the cover of Newsweek, they say, welcome to the new police state, and it's got, it's got a cop in tactical gear, and nobody's freaking out about this. And I'm trying to figure out why that is. I think that they've got a lot of weaponry and a lot of tactical stuff that I'm trying to figure out why my local police officer needs it.
Sure. What I believe the purpose of this, much of this, the militarization and federalization of local law enforcement, is because the agenda that the Obama administration, the Bush administration as well, basically the agenda that's been going on for quite some time through various presidential administration is against the people inherently, and they're basically creating an environment where the individuals at the bottom level, whenever civil unrest eventually occurs because the people no longer can take the overtaxation, the straight-up pillaging of the resources of the American public, they won't be able to resist because they would have already put in the system of enforcement to basically make resistance impossible. That's why it's, again, so important that people get active right now, because we see, you know, me and Catherine are looking at it, you know, straight on. In many instances, they're labeling the Patriot Movement. They're saying it's a threat. They're saying Tea Parties are a threat. And it's happening right now, and we're witnessing it, unfortunately.
Let's get back to this concept of data. Last week, we heard about President Obama. He's talking about collecting DNA from every person that is arrested in the United States of America, which, to me, gross violation of the Fourth Amendment. There's no conviction, and they want me to turn over, you know, this information about myself that I don't want anybody to have. But again, all that data could potentially be aggregated at a fusion center, correct?
Yes. It's interesting. The police chief in Austin, the Police Chiefs Association, or the Major Cities Chiefs Association of Texas, and their last legislative agenda for 2009, one of the things, there was a bill that actually, it never got anywhere, but they wanted to create a, where you have to mandatorily give a DNA sample for Class B misdemeanor suspects and up. So you don't have to be convicted for this. If you're merely suspected of a crime, they instantly collect your DNA, and gross violations all across the board. But yeah, this could fit into the fusion center, and it already is in many of the different fusion centers. A lot of them are different, but the federal government, the Department of Justice's guidelines, called the Federal Fusion Center Guidelines, and just Google Fusion Center Guidelines. The Appendix C, it's called Functional Categories, and it lists a number of different areas where fusion centers could potentially collect information. It says this list is by no means exhaustive. You have banking and finance information to tie in with the banking reform bills that they're passing. You have municipal energy use to tie in with the cap and trade agenda, the Agenda 21 agenda as well. And then, of course, they call for health and human services and health services to be collected. So potentially the fusion centers, which interestingly enough started through the Joint Terrorism Task Force to prevent terrorism. Then after 9/11, they started taking an all crimes approach through the fusion center. Now they're doing an all hazards approach. And one of the hazards could potentially be a breakout or like the swine flu, a pandemic. And what they want to be able to do, you also see IBM commercials saying the same thing, you know, in a smarter, a better world, tracking viruses across large geographic areas. So they want, without our permission, they want to start collecting, you know, all of our flu information. You know, every time you go to the doctor for any symptom, it'll go through a fusion center of sort that deal with all of that and tie in. And that's part of the all-hazards approach that Fusion is now taking. So, yeah, you could bet your bottom dollar that with the expansion of the government-run healthcare, they'll be including more and more and more information. Their ultimate goal is basically to collect every single bit of information that they could possibly get their hands on. And with the technology that we have today, they're actually capable of doing it. And they're building massive supercomputers and storage facilities that are taking more energy than, you know, the largest cities in the country. National security agencies tap into it too. But definitely, we should definitely be concerned about it, especially with the passage of the health care bill.
Yeah, that's a huge concern. I mean, the more government gets involved with health care, the more that, you know, those types of things are going to play in. Who knows? Maybe someone from a federal department will be coming to visit you to confiscate your firearms because you're on a particular type of antidepressant medication. Maybe, you know, someone's going to visit you to talk to you about your diet because, you know, you're obviously, you've got a cholesterol problem. You know, these types of things are not beyond the realm of possibility. The more that the government knows about you, the more they can be intrusive in your life. Now, I think one of the things that's difficult for some people about fusion centers, I mean, if you listen and you're kind of, you know, being a passive listener and listening to what you're saying, I mean, some of what they do has, I mean, if they're truly going, for example, over after terrorists that could potentially be attacking our nation, you know, that there could be some value there. But it's basically the government is spying on you.
Yeah, for sure. There was a program in 2002 called the Total Information Awareness Program underneath DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. And basically, they were creating software that was capable of taking massive amounts of data, running it through complex algorithms, and effectively predicting and tracking and analyzing future trends. And of course, there was a movie called Minority Report where they're eventually able to predict pre-crimes, and based on all of your actions, your decisions, your choices, your health, your mental capacity, your previous work, your relationships, we've created a sort of template or a character pattern that you're taking, and they could potentially say, you know, these individuals could potentially be dissidents. A lot of that stuff, it sounds far-fetched, but as you said before, you know, they used the IRS against political dissidents in the past. Who's to say they're not going to use this universal health care? Who's to say they're not going to have control of your information and be able to kick you out of your daily activities, like the Real ID Act? if they want everybody to have a national ID card, basically what they could effectively do through that RFID chip is if you step out of line or if you get behind on your property taxes or if you get behind on your income tax especially, they simply shut off your little ID card. They have control of all of your information. You can't conduct business unless this card's on. So definitely dangerous for them to have control of the information. That's one of the reasons why people should be so concerned. For people to think that the government isn't capable of misusing such power and such access to information, they did it in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with the counterintelligence program against peaceful activists. And still to this day, the fusion centers are now being used against peaceful protesters and peaceful activists. And again, we see them labeling much of the patriot movement and the beliefs that people have against Real ID and North American Union as well. So it's definitely a cause for concern. That Total Information Awareness Program, which much of the technology and the programs and software that they use in these fusion centers arose from, was later defunded in 2 years because the Congress did a big research on it and found that the technology they were dealing with was way too invasive. But the program didn't go away. It simply went into other different, went into a couple FEMA programs and other Department of Defense programs as well. And now we see it resurfacing through the fusion center apparatus.
Well, here's the last question about fusion centers for you, John. Obviously, a lot of people hearing about fusion centers for the first time today because it's not something that's, talked about a lot. So if we don't know what they are, where they are, what they do, what the heck do we do about it? What can we do as citizens to stop this kind of stuff from taking place?
Sure, and that's the most important question that you could ask. Catherine Blatch and myself have took it upon ourselves and our organization, Liberty Restoration Project, and Texans for Accountable Government, respectively, to join forces in a mission called Operation Defuse. Basically, what we're doing is touring the country, visiting the various fusion centers, but we're hoping to build relationships and to reach out to these individuals that are the heads of these fusion centers and show them that we are not a violent threat, that they don't have anything to fear, liberty-loving Americans that are trying to do our part in order to better our country. Well, we're much like you are. We call it humanizing. And what we've learned really is a lot of the people that are actually operating these fusion centers and the detectives and analysts working at these fusion centers, much of them are just, normal average Joes that are just working to, provide sustenance for their family, and they think that they're doing a good thing for their community. Now, mind you, there's a small percentage of manipulators at the top, probably working for the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security, and who knows what Janet Napolitano is up to. But the people at the ground level, there is potential for we patriots and we Americans to reach out to them and say, hey, man, we're not your enemy, like the establishment would have you believe. We're your brother. We're your fellow American. We're struggling, too. It's tough for us to pay the bills as well. They're both operating against us. We're the common folks. If the order does come down from above that it's time to go gun grabbing or time to squash some dissent, then they'll know that, wow, these people aren't violent. They'll have more of a susceptibility to disobeying their unconstitutional orders if they know the people in the community. But also in doing so, we're really learning a lot about how the system actually works. And one of the things that we're about to do is initiate a nationwide open records request all across the entire country to all 72 fusion centers to get their teacher reports, their funding, their budget, the databases they have access to more better understand their network. We're going to take that and we're going to create our own fusion center that patriots and liberty activists can use in order to better understand the state. And also, we're going to investigate tyrannical public officials so we can, expose them in the light of day, help push them out of office. So we hope to basically mimic the tactics that they're using, turn the cameras around, and, we'll start being, little brother to big brother and start pestering the surveillance state and really getting in there and building these relationships with them and trying to defuse the tension that's starting to build up. That's another reason why we call it Operation Defuse. But if people want to participate, and there's so much that people can do to get involved in order to limit their ability to influence us in a negative way, and eventually when we get involved enough, we'll be able to eliminate them entirely, and eventually we'd like to kick the Department of Homeland Security out of every state in this union, send them back to their borders in D.C. But that's OperationDefuse.com. If people are willing to donate, we operate on a volunteer basis, traveling around the country, visiting people. And we're also going to be doing the open records request and hopefully getting a lot of that hard copy of all of that information as well. But again, there's a lot that people can do to get involved in their local community with their fusion center down at home. We're hoping to empower people and provide them with the resources and guidance necessary in order to prevent the fusion centers in their neck of the woods from abusing the people down there. like they have in other states.
Last question for you. Big question, looking for a short answer. This is something that I've been studying a lot. You know, we've got this concept of liberty in the United States. It's something that supposedly is our defining principle as a people. But the big question is, these days, is liberty an illusion?
Is liberty an illusion? No. Liberty's real. If you're in control of your own thoughts and your own destiny, then freedom is real. And even if they enslave your body, if you never allow them to take your mind, then truly you'll still remain free. The illusion really is their control and the power that they have over us. When you think about it, the elite and the people that control the mechanism of government, the coercive arm of government, they're very few in numbers. We greatly outnumber them. It's just that we voluntarily are obedient to them because we believe that obedience to the law is obedience to justice and obedience to freedom and obedience to what is good. But unfortunately for us, some very evil people have taken control of the arms of power, the reins of power, and it's up to we the people to recognize that obedience to the law is not necessarily justice and is not necessarily what we ought to be doing. It's not the moral thing, the right thing to do. Everybody knows in their heart what is right. You don't harm other people. You don't harm innocents. You don't cause any harm to anybody's property. You don't steal from people. No theft or fraud. When that's not happening, then there's no reason for the state to come in and make laws to control our lives. We know how to control our lives the best. So people realize that. I believe that their own personal moral code, as long as it doesn't interfere with other people's moral codes and them going about their daily lives, that's what the law truly is.
Well, I don't think we could bring it any more full circle if we had tried. So we're now back to individual activism and being involved. And, John, I really thank you for all the work that you're doing out there on the Liberty Trail. And thanks so much for joining us, John Bush, OperationDefuse.com. Coming up next, historical revisionism and the future of history. Professor Larry Schweikert from the University of Dayton joins us to talk about his book, A Patriot's History of the United States, right here on Paradigm Shift.
They fall in line, one at a time, ready to play. I can't see them anyway. No time to lose, we've got to move. Steady to hell, I am losing my head. Fire your guns, it's time to hurt. Blow me away.
Thomas Jefferson, the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. We're talking bloodshed if necessary. Abraham Lincoln, we the people are the rightful masters of Congress and the courts. Not to overthrow the Constitution, but to overthrow the men who pervert the Constitution. Is it time now to raise your hand and say, you know, I tend to disagree with all of this? Bang! You're dead. It's too late to complain. You should have complained at the beginning, when you at least had a chance. How bad do things have to get before you do something? Do they have to be throwing you on cattle cars before you start to say, now wait a minute, I don't think this is a good idea? How long is it going to be before you finally resist and say, no, I will not comply, period?
And of course, that is the voice of constitutional author and lecturer Michael Bednarik. You can catch his entire class online at commonsensejeff.com. Welcome back to Paradigm Shift. I'm Jeff Williams. On April 19, 1775, at Lexington and Concord, the Revolutionary War began after British soldiers attempted to capture Samuel Adams and John Hancock and confiscate rifles, ball, and powder. Now, there are a lot of radio hosts and political leaders out there who will, rightly so, tell you to avoid violence at all costs. And the progressive movement and the social democrats are going far out of their way to paint the liberty movement as heavily armed radicals who wish to incite violence and create mayhem. Now, I pray to God that this movement never has a reason to become violent. We should always work to achieve our means via peaceful methods. But I'm going to say what mainstream hosts won't, and that is, at some point, if pushed far enough past the breaking point by the government, if our constitutionally enumerated rights are trampled into the ground by tyranny, we may not have another avenue. There are some other crazy radicals that had a similar idea, And they put it this way: whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. This is the truth. If it ever comes to violence, it could easily be the worst, darkest chapter in our nation's history. And again, violence should be avoided at all costs, without question. But I'm a firm believer in knowing what you believe in and taking a stand. So I challenge each and every one of you listening to this podcast to seriously think about this subject. You know, when a heart surgeon opens the chest of another human being to repair this vital organ, he or she does not do so without a well-considered plan. Doctors consider a multitude of possibilities and what their immediate reactions will be. Everything is a part of the plan. There are a few surprises. Everything, as a result, always stays under control. So I'm going to ask you this question not to incite violence, but to possibly avoid it. What would it take to drive you to civil disobedience, to break the law, to take up arms? There's a saying out there that I've become familiar with recently: the moral man demands what is just, right, and fair. When no one responds, he rolls up his sleeves and he uses force. Now I want to make it clear, there's a lot of different ways to apply real force other than just physical attacks on other people or property. I don't care about your political persuasion. I don't want to know any of your biases. But here's my question to you. What is your tipping point? What act of the government or your fellow citizens would make you really put your ass on the line? Lives, fortunes, sacred honor kind of stuff. Get in touch with us on our Skype listener feedback line for this exercise. If you don't want to, you don't need to leave your name and state. Just leave us a message and answer the question. If you don't have Skype, pick up the phone and call us. 509-850-3355. What is your tipping point? What is your line in the sand? 509-850-3355. That's 509-850-3355. Or you can Skype us direct at Common Sense Jeff. For the past three decades, many history professors have allowed their biases to distort the way America's past is taught. These intellectuals have searched for the instances of racism, sexism, and bigotry in our history while downplaying the greatness of America's patriots and the achievements of dead white men. As a result, more emphasis is placed on Harriet Tubman than on George Washington, more about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II than about D-Day or Iwo Jima, more on the dangers we faced from Joseph McCarthy than those we faced from Joseph Stalin. A Patriot's History of the United States corrects those doctrinaire biases. In his groundbreaking book, America's Discovery, Founding, and Developments are re-examined with an appreciation for the elements of public virtue, personal liberty, and private property that make this nation uniquely successful. This book offers a long overdue acknowledgement of America's true and proud history. Again, the name of the book is A Patriot's History of the United States, From Columbus's Great Discovery to the War on Terror. The author, at least one of the authors, is Larry Schweikert, and he joins me now on Paradigm Shift. Mr. Schweikert, thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
So I guess one of the first questions I have before we get into this book and your forthcoming book as well, what is it about history that animates you personally?
Well, first of all, the stories are terrific. I mean, you can't make some of this stuff up, what people have done in the past. And then the second thing is, of course, history can be a guidepost, a highway map to the future, if you will allow it to be, because, you know, humans tend to make the same errors over and over again.
I'm always amazed when I'm looking at the problems that are facing our nation now, if one goes back and reads the writings of the Founding Fathers and the Federalist Papers, they kind of predicted just about everything that we're going through right now, didn't they?
Well, these fights have always been going on. You know, what should be the power of the federal government? What should the debt levels of the nation be, if at all? When is it acceptable to go to war? What's the relationship between the church and the state? So these issues have been debated many times in the past, and certainly in the founding generation, they debated all these issues.
About a couple years ago, an author by the name of Bill Bennett, who I'm sure you're familiar with, came out with a two-part series of books that I purchased called America, the Last Best Hope. And one of the reasons why I bought these books, I actually bought them for myself and then I bought copies for my kids, is at the time and even now, and this is one of the reasons why I'm going to be buying your book as soon as I can find it in hardcover, which has proven to be difficult, it seems like our history is disappearing before our very eyes. Do you share that? I mean, you must share that to a certain extent, otherwise you might not have written this book.
Right. I mean, you go to universities today, for example, and they no longer teach courses called the Revolution and Constitution or Early Republic or even American Civil War sometimes. Everything has become theme-oriented, race, class, gender, and so when you lose these periods, whether it's the Jacksonian era or the era of good feelings or the Gilded Age, whatever it is, you lose the framework within which people do history. You can't just do historical methodology and claim to be teaching students. I know a number of people who advocate that. Well, we don't want to teach you content. We want to teach you to think. Well, but think about what? You have to have something to think about in order to learn to think. You know, all anyone needs to learn to think is a course in logic. One semester class in logic in a university should be sufficient to teach anyone how to think. So the rest of the stuff is really not, should not be aimed at teaching students to think. It ought to be giving them a background, a body of knowledge that they can then use that class where they learned how to think about these things.
Right. I think the critical thinking is the most important thing that has been taken away from today's generation. They don't know how to do it. And, you know, just like you said, if you don't have the foundational information on which to base your argument, how can you argue anything? I mean,
critical thinking has kind of gone away in part because in many areas, certainly of history, you're not allowed to challenge the status quo or to make a serious argument against the status quo. For example, the New Deal. It's just a kind of staple of history classes or of textbooks that Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression, that big business got us into the Great Depression, and there's virtually no real substantive discussion of, you know, did Roosevelt actually hurt us? Did he extend the Great Depression? Did his actions actually condemn millions and millions of Americans to more poverty than they should have been exposed? So there is this throughout. Now, in places you'll get critical thinking. I mean, it's okay to say, well, gee, was Lincoln a racist? You know, so they can ask those questions, but there are other questions that have just become off the table to ask.
Right, as long as it suits their own personal agenda, then it's fine to ask those questions. But if it might conflict with something that they believe in, you know, we just got to put the blinders on.
Yeah, and that goes almost across the curriculum.
You know, there's an interesting quote about history, and I might be getting it wrong a little bit here, but the general gist of it is history is written by the victors. And that makes sense to me, but when did the progressive movement win? Because it seems that they have done a great job of rewriting our history, but last time I checked, I mean, they're in power now, but have they been calling the shots to that extent to this point, or have we just been not paying attention?
Well, the progressives made a dramatic shift in terms of political parties away from the Republicans in the 19-teens and 20s and into the Democratic Party by the 1930s. And when did they win? They won by the end of the New Deal. By the end of the New Deal, big government was accepted as the, you know, primary solution to all the world's ills. It's the way that you get people out of poverty. It's the way that you raise incomes. Whatever the question was, after the New Deal, the progressive historians tended to write things in terms of government is the answer. And, of course, we know from Ronald Reagan that government's the problem, it's not the solution.
Now, you've got a new book that's coming out, it looks like in June, Seven Events That Made America, America.
Right.
Without giving it away, because obviously if you just tell us the seven events now, nobody will want to go out and buy the book. Okay, well, what are some of the events that you see as being moments in our history that without them we just aren't the nation that we are?
Well, one of the little-known events that, that has shaped us and continues to shape us was the Missouri Compromise in 1820 led New York politician Martin Van Buren to create a political party, later becomes known as the Democratic Party. And the purpose of this party was to deflect all discussion about slavery, to keep slavery out of the national debate. Now, this is well-intentioned because Van Buren didn't want a civil war, but the result of that was that he creates a party that tells people they cannot be allowed to have an ideology, that they essentially are a party of foils and patronage, that they will be rewarded with jobs, whether it's party jobs or government jobs, if they just toe the party line. So if you were anti-slave back then, you shut up and went along with the majority. Now, does that sound like Bart Stupak or what?
Just a touch.
Yeah, so there's this kind of thing. But my favorite chapter, and we're actually making a documentary film about this chapter, is that rock and roll helped bring down the Iron Curtain. We call it Rock and the Wall, and it's about how rock music, which is completely free in America, I think what a lot of people forget is that jazz, country, and rock had virtually no government support. I mean, there's no government support for this stuff. And yet they go on to make some of the greatest music in the world, and to this day, the world is dominated by American rock and roll music. Doesn't matter what country you go to, you're listening to American music. We're not listening to Ravi Shankar anymore. You know, nobody listens to Islamic folk dances. They listen to rock and roll. And I think the question of why that happened is a pretty interesting question we deal with.
And, of course, this goes back to your roots in rock and roll, probably, as a drummer. You played for the biography I have before me said that you actually opened for Steppenwolf at one point in your life.
Yeah, we opened for a number of groups. And you know, the interesting thing about rock and roll, if you think about it, this goes for country and jazz, but since rock is so much more powerful as a medium, and we're talking about rock and roll is essentially American. It is the American music. There's no other music in the world like it, because the structure of rock is such that you start together, then you have the solo, and then you end the song together. But every rock song has to feature a solo. Well, that's a perfect picture of America. We work together on projects, but you can never do away with the individuality of America.
That's a great metaphor. I never thought of it that way before, but you're absolutely right. You know, when I look back at American history, and this even kind of touches on partially on, you know, what you just mentioned as a defining moment. You know, there was that moment where they were sitting there framing the Constitution and making compromises on the issue of slavery. And even up to including issues surrounding the 14th Amendment, I personally don't think there is one issue that has done more damage to our nation than slavery. Do you think maybe in retrospect, not dealing with it at the time, I mean, obviously if they hadn't dealt with it in the way they did, they probably would have never gotten a constitution, never even had a nation. But look at the trouble that has caused throughout our history as a nation. There's got to be one thing. It has to be that, doesn't it?
You're absolutely right on the issue of slavery, and it's even before the Constitution. Don't forget that there was a big debate in the Continental Congress when they went to issue the Declaration of Independence. And Jefferson put a phrase in there about, you know, King George has given us this terrible institution of slavery. And the Southern delegates, particularly South Carolina, would not tolerate any language whatsoever about slavery in that document, and they threatened to walk out and not support the revolution if there was any discussion of slavery in the Declaration. So it goes back before the Constitutional Convention. To say we wouldn't have had a Constitution, we might not have had a revolution, certainly wouldn't have had a Declaration, if they tried to deal with slavery in 1776.
As a historian, you look backwards. It's your job to, you know, see where we've been. But I think that you could probably get a feel for where we're going as well. We're obviously entering, if we're not already there, entering a period of some tumult in our nation. What do you think history will look at this period and say about us, and where do you think we go from here?
Well, in a lot of ways, this is the domestic equivalent of Chamberlain's England as Hitler was ravaging Europe. I mean, it's turning your head and pretending that problems such as the bankruptcy of Medicare, of Social Security, that those don't exist, in pretending that a $12 trillion debt somehow won't produce hyperinflation at some point, that you can have the government take over 1/7 of the U.S. economy and not absolutely destroy productivity, let alone wipe out the most effective healthcare system in the world. So these are very troubling times. I mean, I see the U.S. entering a period of decline. I'm not a pessimist or a defeatist, but sometimes you have to go into a trough, you know, like an alcoholic, before you can look back up and say, I need to sober up here. And that's where we were in 1979. But I think this time might take a little longer.
How do you think history will look on this new movement in America that is called the Tea Party movement?
Well, it kind of depends on how long it goes and what it does from here. If it were to stop today, it probably wouldn't amount to much. So we don't know if we're looking at, for example, the beginning of the Republican Party in the early 1850s, or if we're looking at the Know-Nothing movement, or if we're looking at the Liberty Party. It's just too early to say. That's why we need history, because it gives us perspective on these things.
Now, being who you are and what you do, I can't imagine that you have too many colleagues in your particular department that just can't wait to invite you to the next party. What is it like? And I'm not even saying you're conservative, because I don't know your politics, but I'm assuming that you're libertarian to conservative just by the way that you base your arguments and frame your stories. What's that like for you?
Well, my colleagues are all polite, and many of them are friendly to a point.
Right.
But you really can't have serious discussions on many of these issues with some of these people, and not just my colleagues, but professors in general, because they operate from such a framework. It's like you're speaking Swahili and they're speaking Eskimo or something. I mean, the languages are just totally different. I literally had one colleague after 9/11, and I mentioned, you know, terrorists did XYZ. Well, who is a terrorist? Now, if you have to ask that question, you're not on planet Earth.
No, it's a different reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting when you have discussions with it. And, you know, I personally like to be challenged by people that have a diametrically opposing viewpoint, because if anything else, it makes me reinforce my own arguments. It makes me actually explain myself and, you know, really think about what it is that I believe in. But when you arm yourself, for example, with history, like one might find in your book, you have this discussion and you get to a point where you're answering all the questions and you're answering them from a factual, historical basis, and there is no escape from that, and then the name-calling begins. And
right.
I personally don't know how to overcome that, and being in a professional situation like that, it must be frustrating.
Well, you know, I have one colleague, one of the people I can most discuss things with, because he is a radical socialist. And he says, I hate liberals, you know, because they go halfway. So we can debate the merits of this program or that program and each one see how the other one is approaching it without the kind of political baggage that goes on in the middle. What I do find, though, and I found this years ago with a colleague who's since passed away, we were talking about how tax cuts always, A, produce prosperity, B, create more revenue to the government, and C, always lower the burden on the middle class and the lower class. And he would just wave these off without ever offering substantial rebuttal. So, yes, you do get to that point, and you know, it's just like the child in the playpen. When things finally don't go their way long enough, they just lash out and smack you with a rattle.
And you think it's just because they have this ideology and they know the roadmap, they're not willing to get off the roadmap. I mean, I guess, you know, even the other night when we were listening to the healthcare debate and the some of the comments that were made after it, you know, I looked at my wife and I said, they can't really believe that.
Yeah, no, they do, and they taught themselves, they train themselves like yoga Zen masters, you know, to believe this stuff regardless of what the evidence says. I mean, liberalism is a religious faith because there is no evidence whatsoever. There is more evidence for Christianity than there is for liberalism, and yet you have to train yourself to believe these ideas and to contend no matter what. You know, what kind of evidence is out there? I mean, I got in a debate with somebody the other day about the uranium that was found in Iraq. Now, this is undeniable. 540 tons of uranium, yellow cake, that they found in Iraq that had to be removed from Iraq. But Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction. It was under Saddam's control. No one was stopping him from accessing it at any time. Who's going to stop him? The UN? You know, but you still get these myths out there. Well, you know, Saddam didn't have WMD.
You know, that actually brings to mind something that I wasn't going to talk about with you, but we can just go through it real quick. You've got a novel that's called September Day about the 9/11 incident.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about history, this one really gets to me because I remember September 11th like it was yesterday, and I want copies of everything that I saw that day. I want video of people jumping out of the buildings. I want to see it. I want to have it. I want to show it to my kids. And where did it all go? There's like a history black hole for 9/11. Everything just was sucked into it, and it's like, in some ways, it's like it didn't exist. That's dangerous. That's dangerous.
That's right. And I show, there's an HBO film called 9/11 New York City in Memoriam. I think that's the title, but 9/11 in Memoriam. It's narrated by Rudy Giuliani, and it's terrific. It's very powerful. And I show that to every class every year, whether it's fall semester or spring semester, so that at least those kids never forget. And some of them are just kind of stunned when they see the pictures of people jumping out of the buildings and, you know, it's a very powerful video.
Well, Mr. Schweikert, I got to tell you, I enjoy history tremendously. I'm really looking forward to reading this book as well as your new book that's coming out in June. Thank you so much for joining us. The book is A Patriot's History of the United States, from Columbus's Great Discovery to the War on Terror. And our guest has been Larry Schweikert. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Jeff.
I love these members that get up and say, read the bill. What good is reading the bill if it's 1,000 pages and you don't have 2 days and two lawyers to find out what it means after you read the bill?
Shaw, read the bill? You got to be kidding me. Well, it's too bad that John Conyers wasn't reading the bill, because if he had, he might have seen what we found. But again, maybe he did know about it and just would rather you didn't read the bill. You're not going to like it. Remember President Obama's proposition for a civilian defense force? I think it's in here, in the health care bill. And we'll talk about it next, right here on Paradigm Shift.
Continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded.
Welcome back to Paradigm Shift. I'm Jeff Williams. That was Barack Obama on the campaign trail in 2008 with a proposal that was not well received by the majority of honest, intelligent Americans. Now, as someone who is involved in the Tea Party movement, I hear all the time that we are simply anti-Obama. Here is something that some people might not admit. The fact of the matter is, We are. We are 100% opposed to the philosophies and initiatives of Barack Obama. And that's where our detractors would like to leave things. But the problem is, equally factual, is that we are opposed to any public official, elected or not, from any party, who would blatantly violate and defy the Constitution, our individual rights, and our liberty. So, by default, Barack Obama is the focus of our concern right now. But it's hard to have it any other way because he is the President of the United States. So now, before we get into this concept of a civilian defense force, let me tell you a little bit about my personal thought process. First, I've always been amused when a person announces they're going to do something, and when they do that, whatever that may be, people get all surprised. I mean, were you not paying attention? Did you just think he was joking? So when Barack Obama set off on what can easily and factually be described as a radical leftist agenda, and millions of moderate voters said, "What the hell?" All I can say is, "What's wrong with you? Were you not paying attention?" I also believe that words mean things. I try to be very specific and concise with my language. You can ask anybody in my family or any of my friends about this. I am not shy about correcting someone when they use a word that is vague or definitionally incorrect.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Fundamentally transform means that there will be radical change. That whatever beliefs or processes were previously used, they were wrong. That we'll be doing business differently, a lot differently. Again, were you not paying attention?
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
How differently, you ask? Have you heard what Obama has said about the Constitution, how he describes its strengths and its weaknesses? Now, I heard the stuff before the election, and of course the media is now a lapdog rather than a watchdog, so you probably didn't hear this on the so-called major channels, but it's indisputable, it's easily accessible, and it's out there.
The Supreme Court never ventured into the issues of redistribution of wealth and sort of more basic issues of political and economic justice in the society. And to that extent, as radical as I think people try to characterize the Warren Court, it wasn't that radical. It didn't break free from the essential constraints that were placed by the Founding Fathers in the Constitution, at least as it's been interpreted, and Warren Court interpreted it in the same way, that generally the Constitution is a charter of negative liberties, says what the states can't do to you, says what the federal government can't do to you, but it doesn't say what the federal government or the state government must do on your behalf.
And as an aside, that's not factually correct. My answer to President Obama on that point would be Article 1, Section 8. And if you don't see what you're wanting there, it's because your viewpoint is diametrically opposed to that of our founders, not because they were wrong. But of course, I digress. The last thing you should know about my thought process is, you've heard of the saying, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Well, I like to take it a step further. If it seems too convenient to be a coincidence, it's probably not. No, I'm not a big believer in large-scale coincidence. But I'm not a conspiracy theorist either. I am a thinker, and I like to think that I'm not easily misled, especially by people who are transparent about their objectives. Now let's take a step back in time to another era where a civilian defense force was considered to be a good idea. And I'm guessing that if you were going to put money on where I'm going with this, you would suggest I'm going to mention Adolf Hitler, the Brown Shirts, and the youth organizations of Nazi Germany. And you'd be 100% incorrect. You know, a lot of people aren't aware of how inspired the Nazis were by the United States progressive movement, specifically the administration of Woodrow Wilson. Now, I'm not going to get into this too much here because I just don't have the time, but take my word for it. Wilson was a seriously bad dude. Personally, I think of Wilson when I think of how bad things could get in the United States, because it's all happened before. Wilson deputized 100,000 Americans to root at all sorts of people under the guise of national security. The Palmer raids terrorized half of America, while the other half was cowed into silence. Newspapers were shut down, books were burned, speakers were silenced, and critics were jailed. And all of this was done through the Espionage Act passed in 1917, which was widely applied to crush out any form of political dissent that President Wilson found offensive. So in a bizarre twist of fate, while I was searching online for something unrelated last week, imagine when I found this article in an archive section of the New York Times, a section that I didn't even know existed. Wilson plans new army in three branches. Senate committee proposes professional force, National Guard, and citizen reserve. For compulsory training, youths of 19 would serve 4 months in camp and 5 years in reserve. And at this point, If you think I'm comparing President Obama to the man I would argue is the worst president in our nation's history, well, now this time you're right.
We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded.
And here's Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel with some additional details.
Citizenship is not an entitlement program. It comes with responsibilities. Everybody somewhere between the ages of 18 and 25 will serve 3 months of basic training and understanding in a kind of civil defense. And you look at World War II, well, that was a draft, but this is not a draft.
So is this compulsory then?
Well, you have to, in a sense, it's a required of everybody, 18 to 25, 3 months. Because I think anytime somebody serves their country in some capacity, we're going to be stronger for it.
And following that up, here are some questions asked by talk show host Glenn Beck of the Fox News Channel. I don't care if you love him or hate him. I defy any person to question or dispute the validity of these particular questions.
I have to ask the reasonable question in these unreasonable times. Who will the civilian national security force protect us from? Mr. President, do you know of a coming event? Could you fill us in? We will help protect the nation. If you know of, tell us. Who builds an army against an unidentified, unrecognized, mysterious threat that doesn't exist?
Well, the good news is there wasn't a book, and he didn't cry. So let's bring this all to a head. I get a lot of email, literally hundreds of pieces of email a day. I filter a lot of it straight to the trash. Some grab my attention, but if the supporting links don't work, they're not worth my time, they go to the trash. But last week, one particular email grabbed my attention. It was about a Ready Reserve Corps that is hidden in the health care bill. The location information was fairly specific, so I went to the Senate's website, I downloaded the bill, and I was dismayed to discover that, as the email had alluded, this thing is real. Again, all these links are in the show notes. H.R. 3590, page 496, Establishing a Ready Reserve Corps. Now, if you read this one page that no one has ever talked about, that is buried in over 2,000 pages of bloated bureaucratic nonsense in what could be the worst piece of legislation of all time, you will discover that this new organization is exceptionally vague in both scope and size and is completely redundant to existing military, paramilitary, and civilian organizations. In other words, regardless of how nefarious this may or may not be, we don't need it. It refers to Commissioned Corps and Ready Reserve Corps, but does not mention from where it will draw its participants. The whole section seems to be like nothing more than a placeholder, structure that has been created to be finished later. So am I being paranoid? Let's examine that. Remember, I don't believe in coincidence, especially large scale. Let's also remember that I take people at their word. And I believe that however philosophically misguided President Obama is, nothing he does should come as a surprise. Case in point, he has literally broadcast everything he has done months, if not years, in advance. So why would it be a stretch for me to take this man at his word?
We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded.
Now, while I cannot definitively say what the Ready Reserve Corps is for, and again, that is because the language of the now law is intentionally about as vague as you could possibly make it, I know President Obama's goals, I know his tactics, and I know that we now have a new pseudo-military organization funded by my tax dollars and your tax dollars to the tune of $50.2 billion, that is billion with a B, $50.2 billion. But don't take my word for it. Do what I did. Do the research. Read it yourself. All the links are in our show notes, and quite frankly, it's about time that we all download this bill and find out what other surprises are waiting for us just around the corner.
It takes a long time to do the necessary administrative steps that have to be taken to put the legislation together to control the people.
Well, that's it. Paradigm shift number 4 is a wrap. Coming up on our next episode, fingers and toes crossed, we hope to be joined by the constitutional sheriff himself, Richard Mack. In the meantime, I am hitting the road. I'm going to be in Moscow, Idaho on April the 15th and Greenville, South Carolina on April the 17th, making speeches to tea parties. If you are the organizer of a tea party event and you're looking for a speaker that hey, knows his stuff and can get the crowd fired up, I would urge you to consider me. I don't charge to come out, just cover my expenses, and I'm happy to do it for the cause. You can reach me through the website at commonsensejeff.com. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its maximum hour of danger. This is that hour. You are that generation. Now is that moment. My name is Jeff Williams, and this has been a Paradigm Shift.
Thank you, Jeff Williams. That was a terrific show. There's a lot going on, folks. We're going to finish this special show up with a little music. There's about 12 minutes left. I'd like to say thank you to everyone who's listening, everyone who will listen. Please go to Jeff's site. I'd like to thank everyone who came on board with us. Special shout out to our soldiers everywhere, retired and active military. Happy Easter, everyone. And rise, America, rise. Good night, everyone.
Darling, won't you stand by me? If the sky, look upon another. Thank you.